Item one, trade war by tweet. Item two, trade war as a game. Item three, oh yeah, Facebook. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, April the 9th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's been a while since we have started this program by dissecting a presidential tweet. But with a whiff of trade war in the air, there is some good economic context to be had from that exercise today. 6:03 in the morning, the president said this. When a car is sent to the United States from China, there is a tariff to be paid of 2.5%. When a car is sent to China from the United States, there is a tariff to be paid of 25%. Does that sound like free or fair trade? No, it sounds like stupid trade going on for years. Believe it or not, the most important part of that whole thing was the last two sentences. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
So about those numbers the president threw out in his tweet.
Yeah, he's right.
Emily Blanchard teaches at Dartmouth. China does have a 25% tariff on all foreign cars, not just American ones, but...
on the surface, yeah, it sounds unfair. In practice, though, the vast majority of U.S. car sales in China aren't imported.
They are made right there in China. The Chinese tariff doesn't apply to them.
U.S. auto manufacturers are doing very well in China indeed. They're producing millions of cars in China and selling them to Chinese consumers.
And yes, China does have higher tariffs on autos than the U.S. does, but the tables are turned when it comes to other goods.
The U.S. tariff on tobacco, for example, is 350%. In China, it's 57%. We have much higher tariffs on clothing and footwear than China has.
Dan Eikenson directs trade policy studies at the Cato Institute. All of that said, there is widespread agreement among economists and business leaders that China is being unfair in a lot of ways.
There is a very big problem in our relationship with China.
Scott Kennedy is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. China does, in general, have higher barriers to foreign goods than the U.S. does. It does force U.S. companies to share their proprietary technology just to do business in China.
Pressure may be needed. Now, whether it's tariffs or something else is really beside the point because the goal is to get China's attention.
The question is how to do that.
No, starting a trade war is typically not a good way to get another country to reduce its tariff.
Emily Blanchard at Dartmouth. An alternative? Get allies who have the same problems with China to band together. But so far, the U.S. has been attacking those allies with tariffs instead. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I think I mentioned on Friday the extremely unscientific Twitter poll I had done on whether people would be willing to pay for Facebook. Of a sample size of 4,100 people, 87% said thank you, no. My survey might have lacked academic rigor. Yes, in fact, it did. But for Facebook and the people running it, how to keep up revenues while dealing with their privacy issues and data is a very real-world concern, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
That Twitter poll inspired me to do a bit of digging on the University of Texas at Austin campus myself. Ike Azatame and Rebecca Stewart are both students here and Facebook users.
As much as I love it, I couldn't see myself paying for it.
If it came down to paying for it, that's a part of my budget I can't afford to spend.
They didn't seem overtly troubled by the data breach or how their information was being distributed to advertisers, and they didn't have plans to delete their accounts.
People in general, but Americans, are definitely willing to sell their privacy for convenience or for discount.
That's Karen North. She teaches digital and social media at USC's Annenberg School. She says Facebook can't easily just ratchet back how much data it collects and sells.
Pretty much their entire revenue model right now is ad revenue.
But some experts believe there are other models Facebook could adopt. Zeynep Tefekcia at the University of North Carolina has written a book about social media. She says if Facebook is serious about its claim to provide value to the user...
well, let them make that case. Deliver that value, make us the customers, and convince people that it's the service worth paying for.
Luke Stark, a fellow at Harvard, says there is a way of carrying on with the ad revenue model, but limiting advertisers' ability to link up particular data with specific users.
So it means you don't get this granular data collection, but you still, you know, you can still presumably sell ads.
Which would still generate revenue, but probably a bit less than Facebook is making right now. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is getting all the attention at the moment. It's not at all a stretch to say that his making the rounds today on Capitol Hill ahead of his testimony tomorrow was a media free-for-all. But it is also true that Zuckerberg is something of a proxy at the moment for the rest of big tech. Facebook's not the only Silicon Valley company that collects and uses and makes money from our data on the one hand, while having privacy issues on the other. So what about those companies, too? Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
While Apple CEO Tim Cook has said his company is open to regulation, Google's been mostly quiet. That's because it's easier for Apple to speak up. Its products are closed platforms. Tim Dirtinger is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Google, he says, is different.
Google doesn't really have a revenue-generating actual physical product. What they have is information and monetizing that information through advertising.
Google has had its scrapes with the FTC that cost the company $22 million in 2012. Part of the settlement included privacy limits, which Google has voluntarily kept in place. So for now, Google is enjoying the show.
They're staying out of the way of the train wreck that is Facebook.
That's Scott Galloway, who wrote The Big Four, a book about Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. He calls Facebook and Google a duopoly, and the concerns around the company's data security very similar, if not the same. Facebook is under government scrutiny, but the whole industry stands to be remolded by regulation. Already, Google and other big tech companies doing business in the EU are scrambling to meet new regulations going into effect May 25th. Jeff Pollard, an analyst at Forrester Research, says Google wants to avoid what it's facing in Europe.
Is some degree of heavy-handed government intervention in the realms of privacy or advertising or customer data.
What Google would like? Probably the opportunity to influence any U.S. regulations that do come by writing rules that land within people's comfort zone when it comes to privacy, but still let Google monetize its businesses. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Traders were having a pretty good day today, and then the last hour of the session made them rethink themselves. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Without casting aspersions on anybody, if you have said at some point in the past couple of weeks, I could totally do a better job with this whole tariff thing than the president seems to be doing, 538 has just the thing for you, a simulation that'll let you decide how friendly, or more likely than not, it turns out, unfriendly you want to be and what happens to you economically either way. We got Oliver Rader, he's a senior writer at 538, into our New York studio so he could watch remotely while I play the thing here in LA and then talk about it a little bit. Oliver, thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so let me describe for folks who maybe are not on 538 every day what I'm looking at. The question is, can you win our trade game? If you both and what happens is I play against some other random 538 reader, right?
That's right.
Okay. If both of us cooperate in a given trade round, we each get $15, mythical bucks, I'm guessing here. You're not going to pay me to do this, right, Oliver?
Yeah, I'm not okay. Cutting checks for...
Fair enough.
Sorry.
If we both defect, that is, not cooperate, we each only own $10, earn $10. And if one cooperates and the other defects, the guy who defects, the guy who betrays the cooperation, gets $25 while the cooperator gets $5. And it's pretty classic prisoner's dilemma setup here, right?
That's exactly right.
All right, good. So my choices of type of traders are the cooperator, the retaliator, the coin flipper, the grudge holder, the copycat, or the defector. So it's a range of basically indexes on this friendliness, imitation, vindictiveness scale, right?
That's right. Or you could be the Kai and you could create a custom.
I try to be the Kai every day, man. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
You can fine-tune each of those bars how you would like.
Yeah, so let me do this. I'm going to set friendliness, that is free trade-ism, at 50%. I'm going to set imitation at 50%. And I'm going to guess the algorithm then adjusts my actions accordingly, right?
That's right.
So basically, I'm straight down the middle on all of these things. And I'm ready if you're ready. You ready?
Let's do it.
Oh, look at this. So my earnings in this round were $1,060. My opponent's earnings were $1,000. So if I played it straight down the middle, it was pretty much net break even.
You edged out your opponent, but what happened here was you were both a little bit unfriendly and you were both a little bit vindictive. And essentially what happened is somebody cheated, somebody imposed tariffs, and the vindictiveness kicked in, and both of you essentially defected, isolating yourself for the rest of the game. So you won, but at a cost. So this is an example of a trade war.
Yeah, and because the cost here is you're sort of below expected performance. That is to say, in the real world, this would look like jobs would be lost, wages would be lower, industries would underperform, those kinds of things.
Exactly. So right. you might have come out ahead relative to your opponent, but you did not come out ahead relative to a free trade baseline.
Got it. So let me ask you, separating from the game for a second, because this is fun, but what did you find amongst the 100,000 or so people who have played this game? I can't imagine even how many rounds that was. It was probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of rounds. What do we do? What's our gut? What's our animal spirits when we get into this game?
What we found were our readers, our hypothetical reader presidents, started off pretty nice. But as they played the game more and more, they became less friendly. They became more vindictive and more trade wars broke out. I should caveat that with there's not the entire global economy resting on this 538 interactive game. We have some power, but not that much power. So there's a lack of incentive, and I wouldn't want to read too much into the results. But yeah, we found people became somewhat less friendly and somewhat more likely to impose these hypothetical tariffs the longer they played.
Acknowledging for a second that, as you say, 538 is powerful, but not that powerful. It's interesting to view the results of this game and some of the articles you guys have written as follow-ups. In terms of what is happening now, in terms of some of the language that you see the president and the Chinese using in a real-world environment.
The hope is that this game will capture some of the salient strategic elements that exist around international trade. And essentially, that is the trade-off between individual incentives and mutual bilateral incentives. So in every period of this game, a country or a reader has an incentive to cheat and to benefit themselves. But in the long run, if we can cooperate, we can both be better off. So that's sort of the tension, what I want to do for myself and what would make the collective whole mm-hmm. better off and the tension between those things.
And what's interesting now is just to keep it in the real world for just a second is we've had, you know, decades of to varying degrees, cooperation in the global economy, right, and in the rules of it. And now President Trump has said, in essence, I'm going to shake things up and we're going to see what's happening.
Exactly. And I think countries have been evolving to this sort of friendly equilibrium, yeah. this equilibrium where they all realize, well, if we all cooperate, we'll all be better off. Trump would probably argue that China was the one who cheated in this game first, mm-hmm. and he's merely responding. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we have, it seems like for the most part, we have kind of found this cooperative equilibrium and that may be being disrupted now.
Oliver Rader, he's a senior writer at 538. I encourage you to play this game. It's absolutely fascinating. And I'll tell you, we have recorded my little session here in the studio on the computer. We're going to put some screenshots up on our website, marketplace.org. You can see what it looks like and how I did, which it turns out was probably toss of the coin. Oliver, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up,
all salaries are frozen and no jobs are being listed, and there was no way that I was going to move up.
Turning financial crisis into opportunity. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here we go. Dow Industrials added 0.1% today, 46 points, close to 23,979. I should say at this point that the Dow was up like 440 or something at one point. Then the last hour went bye-bye. The NASDAQ picked up 0.5%, 35.6950. The S&P 500 gained 0.3%, 8 points, 26.13. A softer tone about that possible trade war with China helped move stocks higher. Today, Lockheed Martin rose 0.3%. Shares of aircraft manufacturer Boeing fell 0.1%. Bond prices, well, they were flat. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect your lives so you can make better decisions. Well, here's your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across this country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can grow and keep getting better. Become a Marketplace investor today. Whatever amount is right for you, it goes twice as far right now. Give online at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We talk a lot about debt on this program because a lot of people in this country have a lot of it. And while not all debt is created equal, sometimes it is treated the same. According to the nonprofit National Bureau for Economic Research, about 43 million Americans owe something near $75 billion in overdue medical bills. And like other kinds of debt, collecting on it can be difficult. So some hospitals are selling that debt to third-party collectors who go after it themselves. From WBEZ in Chicago, Miles Bryan has the story.
Halfway through my interview with Essie and Barbara Richardson at their Chicago home, Barbara has to take a call.
That was them calling just now.
What do you mean?
The collection agency was just calling. They called at 1 o'clock. This is 5 o'clock. So they called throughout the day.
The agency's calling because Barbara's 77-year-old mom, Essie, has some unpaid bills from Cook County Health and Hospital System. That's the Chicago area's big public hospital. Essie ended up there for about a week in late 2016 for what may have been gout.
I have arthritis pretty bad. My arm was swell, and they were saying it was fluid I had built up in my arm.
Essie says she lives off about $1,400 a month from Social Security and is on Medicare. She thought she wouldn't have any out-of-pocket medical payments. But she says, according to the county, she owes about $225. And a few months ago, the calls started from one of the collection agencies the county works with. Essie and Barbara Richardson say they have not paid any of the bills yet. And some politicians around here say unpaid medical bills are a problem.
We're not running a charity hospital.
Richard Boykin is a Cook County commissioner.
The reality of it is that we ought to collect that money on behalf of the taxpayer.
Boykin's been pushing the county health system to stop sending unpaid bills like Essie Richardson's to contracted collection agencies and instead sell the right to collect that debt to a private company. To understand the thinking behind that, you've got to know two things. One is that right now, Cook County's health system imposes some restrictions on its collection agencies. They can't sue someone for unpaid bills without the county's permission, for example. And two, those agencies generally collect less than 5% of the bills they go after. Boykin thinks the county's roughly $170 million currently out with collection agencies might be more valuable to a buyer that could go after it a little more aggressively.
If we can sell it for $20, $30 million, then obviously that's 20 to 30 million more that we have in the county coffers.
Right now, this idea is stalled in Chicago. The first request for proposal didn't get any bids, but it's happening around the country. Medical debt sales made up more than a quarter of all debt buying analyzed in a 2013 federal report. That concerns Susan Cherry with the Boston-based healthcare consumer advocacy group Community Catalyst.
I think what you end up with is potentially back to the bad old days, things like wage garnishment, body arrest, like literally arresting people for debt.
There are state and federal rules that limit medical debt collection. But Cherry says the farther the debt gets away from the hospital that issued it, the more that problems can come up. A few years ago, an emergency room provider in St. Louis sold its medical debt to a third-party buyer. Since then, that company has sued over 1,000 people for unpaid bills, according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Cherry says that can go against a hospital's core mission to serve.
You're talking about particularly vulnerable people, you know, who don't have a lot of money to begin with.
Barbara Richardson, whose mom owes money to the Cook County Hospital, says she thinks collectors are trying hard enough to get money from her mom as it is.
If they're going to be even more aggressive than these people are, I don't know what she's going to do.
Barbara says she hopes she can convince the hospital to write off her mom's bills. In Chicago, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
Where we are in this economy today has a whole lot to do with what happened in this economy 10 years ago and how all of our lives changed with the financial crisis. Our project covering the 10 years we have all just lived through is called Divided Decade, stories in part about how people's lives have turned in unexpected ways. Ann Shun is an illustrator and author. You can find her work on Instagram and Facebook and on greeting cards and postcards and calendars and stickers and pins and keychains. Her first book, though, it's called Bad Girls Throughout History, came out a couple of years ago. Her latest is called Legendary Ladies, and it's good to have you here.
Hi.
For those who can't see the books that I have here in front of me, and they can go online, and we'll have pictures and stuff at marketplace.org. Describe your art style for me, would you?
Well, I paint in gouache, which is an opaque watercolor, and it's very influenced by 50s fashion illustration.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. I can totally see that.
Yeah, I love that style and that sophistication of work, but I want to apply it to a more inclusive representation of women and people.
How much of your time is Ann Shun artist versus Ann Shun small businesswoman?
Oh, God. Probably 80% is the business and 20%
really?
Is the artwork. Yeah.
Wow, did I not have that right? Well, how can you possibly output all the art you make when you're spending so much time running your business?
Well, it's just a lot of density of work in both. When I have the time to make the work, I get into like flow and I'm like a juggernaut mm-hmm. when I do that. And mm-hmm. then when I'm in the business, it's every aspect of it. It's accounting, it's doing the planning, and then also my own marketing for it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you get started doing this?
So I graduated college in 2006. I went to UCSD, so I went to a large university and studied writing. So I didn't have a whole lot of other technical skills besides that. So I worked for a few years in nonprofits here in LA. And then 2008 happened, and then I couldn't get another job. I hated the job I was in. And then I thought, well, I'm spending all my time reading design blogs and looking at artists' work, so maybe I should do that. So I decided to take a figure drawing class, and then I decided to go to art school.
Yeah, clearly you've got skills, right? I mean, you look at these books and...
You know, I actually didn't draw that much until I decided I wanted to in my 20s. I didn't know anyone who went to art school or was a working artist, so I didn't know how to do that. And then my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, he was going to CalArts, and I finally went on to this campus and saw all these people doing this, and there was a connection there for me of, oh, this is how you can make it a career.
Huh.
So then, and I was also meeting people who were going back to school around that time later in life for a second act. And so I was like, I'm going to school. I'm going back to art school.
And so you made the investment, as many did during the financial crisis, since you couldn't get the job you wanted, you went back and got training.
Yeah, because all salaries were frozen and no jobs were being listed, and I just felt stuck, and I was still at entry level at that point. I had done everything I thought I was supposed to do right. Like, I was an excellent student. I went to a UC that was a really great school. I had graduated with honors. And then all that was on the other side was just entry-level jobs that were like administrative assistants. And so I realized there's no more path set out for me, and I'd done everything right, and I'm still not getting anywhere I want to get. Then I need to start making my own path.
How different do you suppose your life would be if, when you'd gotten out of school in 2006, the economy wasn't headed for a crash and things had been humming right along? Would you be here?
I don't think I would have taken the risks that I did that early on in my career. I wouldn't have felt confident or secure enough. I felt like I had nothing to lose then because we were all stuck. So I might as well take time out to go back to school and learn a skill and do something I've always wanted to do.
How's business now? It sounds like you're busy.
It's great. Yeah, it's really great. I've been working for myself for 4 years now, which is the longest job I've ever kept.
Is it terrifying?
You know, some days it is, but it gets easier. The things that used to terrify me like 4 years ago don't scare me as much anymore. But it's new.
bigger things that scare me.
And Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We've got some examples of Anne's work on our Instagram. You can see it at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, tell us the story of how the financial crisis might have changed your life. This final note on the way out today comes to us from the Marketplace desk of Cognitive Economic Dissonance and features two things: a report from the Congressional Budget Office out this afternoon and a vote set for the House of Representatives later this week. The CBO came out with its budget and economic outlook for the years 2018 to 2028 today. It says, among other things, economic growth this year should be strong and then moderate quite a bit. The authors also note they have taken into account the effects of both the Trump tax cuts and the government spending bill that was passed and signed a couple of weeks ago. And as a result, the nonpartisan agency says federal budget deficits, that is the amount the government spends above and beyond what it takes in every year, will hit $1 trillion annually by 2020. That is every single year through the end of 2028, the end of the report. So that is item one. Item two is that on Thursday, as things stand now, Republican leaders are set to hold a floor vote to amend the Constitution to require a balanced federal budget every year. All right, we got to go. Wall Street today, kind of a wash after a big start. Things faded at the end. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.